Hi, welcome to Things in Jars, a podcast about oddities, curiosities, and all the weird and wonderful stuff that dwells in museum stores. I'm Melissa.
And I'm Poppy, and we're both curators, here to take you behind the scenes of the museum with us as we explore cool artifacts and answer your questions about what it's really like to work in a museum.
Welcome to another episode of Things in Jars. And this week, we are very excited to be bringing you an episode dedicated to dolls' houses. How do you feel about that?
I feel good about it. Good. I'm excited to hear about your dolls' houses. And I finally found something worthy of sharing, so...
Yeah, you've had a struggle with this one, haven't you?
Yeah, this was one that I found very unyielding. Because, I mean, there are so many beautiful dollhouses out there, don't get me wrong. But I wanted one that had a story attached to it.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, I mean, what do you say other than this collection has a really beautiful one and it's an exact model of this house and everything's really small? Like, there has to be a story. Because this is not a visual platform. We have to create the world with our words.
Yes, Poppy. That's very correct. We must. And that is what we will do.
It's what we'll try to do with the aid of story.
Yes. And I think, as you said last time, dolls' houses have such potential to be so intriguing and interesting and have such great stories attached to them.
If I may, I believe it was you that said that. So, you know, give yourself credit, girl.
Oh.
That was okay. A you nugget of wisdom, that.
No, I thought it was you. Oh, well. I mean, we are one voice after all, so.
That's true. Yeah, fair enough. So, tell me about your item spotlight of the week.
I have chosen a special walking stick from the Whipple Museum. And the reason why it's special is because it has a secret compartment.
Oh.
And there's something kept inside. What might it be?
Is it a weapon?
It's not a weapon.
Ink. Quill and ink.
It's not a quill and ink. It is a leech.
What?
So I'll leave you with that. It's a leech walking stick. And we'll come back to that later. Before we get into the rest of the episode, we'd just like to clarify that opinions expressed in this show are our own, and Things in Jars is not affiliated with the museum in which we work, although we will be referring a lot to its wonderful collection. Okay, so, from our collection at Wordsworth Grasmere, I have to admit that I really didn't find anything of great intrigue or interest, to be honest.
Yeah, it's not an obvious one for us, is it? I mean, I can tell you now, we don't have any dolls' houses.
No, we don't. We have a miniature dove cottage that's been made, which is quite nice, but that's not a doll's house.
People have, over the years, given us models that they themselves have crafted. And these are always very sweet.
I would love an actual dollhouse of Dove Cottage.
Wouldn't that be great?
This time last year, just when we first started being on furlough, I was on The Sims and I made Dove Cottage on The Sims. Do you remember that?
I remember that.
Oh, yeah. That was a time in my life. I made it so well, if I do say so myself. I spent hours crafting the garden and the house, and I made William and Dorothy and Mary live there, and it was great. And I played it for like 5 days straight, and then I've never played it since. So.
Oh no.
But I feel like Dove Cottage would make a lovely dollhouse.
It would. It would also be nice to have a dollhouse that the children themselves had, but then they just weren't that kind of family. Like, they were very, I don't know, Dora had a toy doll, but it was made of like a handkerchief. So they were just very kind of rustic.
They were encouraged to play out of doors, weren't they?
Yes, they were.
And why wouldn't you? When you live in a lovely place such as Grasmere, amongst the hills and lakes and trees.
Yes.
But I bet Dora indeed secretly wanted a dollhouse, so.
She loved her little hanky doll.
She did.
Yeah. Dorothy tells us in a letter that she has been kissing it and making imaginary tea parties for it and things like that. Which That's is very cute. Yeah. So what did you find? I'm not taking no for an answer. You have to deliver some goods.
Oh, I found something. It's very relevant. It's just not that interesting. Or it could be. I just don't know much more about it other than what is in the catalogue record, which is not a great deal. So we do have a model bedroom. So like a dollhouse size model bedroom from 1830. And it was given by the Mrs. Simpson. So more than one Miss Simpson. Before 1938. And that is all we know about it. So, yes. That is...
mystery.
That is exactly what Poppy, what you didn't wish to include in this episode, because it completely lacks a story and is not interesting in the slightest. I mean, we could make a story up.
But yeah, that's fine.
Maybe...
But no fake news.
No fake news. Maybe we should write our debut novel about this.
The bedroom set at Dove Cottage.
But anyway, what did you find?
So I did some digging through Dorothy's letters just to see if there was anything in there. Maybe they got one for Dora or a niece or a nephew later in life. You just never know. So I had a look. And what I did find was a reference, just one, in all of the Wordsworth letters. I tried everyone, even Sarah Coleridge. I tried the wider circle as well. I was determined. And in a letter sent on May the 23rd, 1791, from one Dorothy Wordsworth to one Miss Jane Pollard, there is the single mention of a baby house.
Oh, a baby house! We remember those.
So a baby house was one of our item spotlights a while back.
Yeah.
So baby houses and dolls houses, actually really similar. Sometimes they're used interchangeably. So it wasn't until a lot later, and I'm talking maybe like the 20th century, that dolls' houses became playthings for children. Initially, when they first started becoming popular in England, it was the ladies of the house, and they were teaching tools in a way, these really grand, fancy houses with all of the tiny, tiny furnishings. Usually they were made as an exact replica of grand houses that these wives, these society ladies lived in. And putting together a house and having this project for women and wives was kind of like the equivalent of a cabinet of curiosities for men. They were these grand showpieces that would impress dinner guests, that would dazzle people with your wealth. They taught children and young women how to put together a home, how to commission furnishings, because again, these were taken very, very seriously. All of the pieces were selected and commissioned from actual furniture makers, just really scaled down versions. So it taught women how to create atmospheres and put together rooms in a fashionable way, and they were just really, you know, a lot more of an insidious history perhaps than a nice toy for a child. Like, they really were,
they had a purpose.
Yeah, they were instructive. They were not for entertainment. They were art. They were actually art. Probably the way to describe them. Art. So Dorothy was clearly familiar with the concept of a baby house. And she's writing to Jane Pollard here. And Dorothy and Jane were friends from their school days. After Dorothy had lost her mum, she was sent out to day school and lived with relatives up in Yorkshire. And that's where she and Jane became very, very close. And I mean, it's 1791, so Dorothy is what? 20?
Yeah,
Dorothy's 20 years old. She's living down in Norfolk in Fawnsett with her aunt and uncle, who she's kind of like home help for when they're growing their family. And she's also a teacher, interestingly. She writes, "Oh, Jane, how much pleasure do I expect from your society when our meeting takes place? How delightful will it be to look back upon those days which we passed together without any troubles, but such as the promise of an hour's play together would at once alleviate. We shall retrace the adventures of the baby house, the little parlour, brackets, I now fancy I see Harriet's shop fixed at one end of the long window seat, The croft, the warehouse, nay, even the back kitchen, where I full well remember a scheme which we formed, and which, if it had not been frustrated, was to have procured us a night's rest together, but alas.
Oh.
Yeah, so I'm not entirely sure what the context of the letter, like, in that particular bit means. I can't work out whether she's describing having this baby house in childhood and she and Jane used to play with it, or I don't know if it was in a shop, like, because she talks about fancy seeing Harriet's shop.
Yeah,
was it in a window and they used to pass it or something like that? I mean, I don't know much about how that would have worked, but I thought really they were more bespoke than that and you wouldn't just buy one. So I wasn't really expecting that. Kind of, I'm glad it's there, but I wish I knew a bit more about what was actually going on.
Yeah.
But yeah, a baby house. A kind of dollhouse.
It's as close as we're going to get, to be fair.
It really is.
Okay. On to the next.
Do you want to start?
Yeah, I do.
Oh,
I do. I'm excited to tell you about this because I've had this in mind for quite some time and it's just beautiful. I'm just going to say that first, it's beautiful. So I want to tell you about the most beautiful dollhouse I have ever seen, which is Colleen Moore's Fairy Castle.
Oh.
Have you heard of this before?
Only through researching for this, yeah.
Have you seen it?
No, I haven't. Shall I Google it?
No, let me tell you about it first.
Oh,
let me
tell
you about it. Let me paint a picture with words, as you said before.
Okay.
And see if you can picture it. So, Colleen Moore was an American actress who was born in 1899, and she began her career as a silent film star. And according to her Wikipedia page, she was one of the most fashionable stars of her time and helped popularise the bobbed haircut. So...
wow, she was, that is some doing.
She was out there. So she was very successful. And along with the stage, she harboured another great love and passion in her life. And she had been fascinated with dolls and dolls' houses since she was a little girl. And she still loved them as an adult. So her father suggested that with her wealth and her fortune, she should create the dollhouse of her dreams. And that is what she did. So she created her very own fairy castle. So in 1928, work began on the dream house. And it was no ordinary project. And it reminded me very much of Queen Mary's dollhouse, which we spoke about in a previous episode, which, you know, it's one of those houses. The scale was small, but the grandeur and the detail and the elaborate nature of everything and the craftsmanship that went into it were off the scale. So a super, super elaborate project. So Colleen enlisted the help of an architect called Horace Jackson and a designer called Harold Grieve to create the Enchanted Castle. And over the next 7 years, the castle began to take shape with 100 people working on it. And it had 1,500 miniatures made at a cost of $500,000. So back then, that is a lot of, I mean, it's a lot of money now, but it was a lot of money back then. And when you look at this castle, it is literally exquisite. Like, that's the only word I can use to describe it, because it the detail in it, everything that you could imagine a fairy castle to have, it has. And the idea behind it was to give the impression that a fairy has just left the room. So everything in it is constructed to look like it's lived in and that they might have just popped out. The castle is in the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago, and their website has this amazing section which lets you virtually explore the castle. And you go on like a magical journey. So I would encourage everyone to go on this journey. And it has this great description. So it describes the castle as following. From the chapel's floor to ceiling stained glass to the flickering of the tiniest lights, every inch on display is a study in artistry and craftsmanship. Poppy's mouth is agape. The fairy castle is virtually a museum within our museum, a collection of miniature treasures in every room, from inch square books signed by the world's greatest authors to statues nearly 2,000 years old. Though the castle's magical residents are never seen, we know for certain they have exquisite taste. Isn't it cool?
It is out of this world.
Don't go through all the rooms, Poppy. I want to tell you about the rooms because I'm too excited. I need to tell you all of the details.
Okay. I'll rein it in.
Rein it in. So there are 12 rooms in the castle. So there's the kitchen, the dining room, Cinderella's drawing room, the great hall, the chapel, the library, the princess's bathroom and bedroom, and the prince's bathroom and bedroom, the attic, and the magic garden. So I could literally tell you everything about every room, but I shan't. I'll just pick out a few highlights. So the kitchen is filled with whimsical wall murals, as the website says, of fairy tales. So it has the three little pigs, Jack and Jill are tumbling down the hill, Humpty Dumpty's there, little Bo Peep is above the stove, and the copper stove is meant to be the stove in which the Wicked Witch locked Hansel and Gretel. Inside the oven is a pie that was baked with 4 and 20 blackbirds. And, speaking of Queen Mary's dollhouse, the Royal Dalton dinner service on the table is an exact replica of the set made for Queen Mary's dollhouse. In the dining room, there is a replica of King Arthur's round table. In Cinderella's drawing room, the reason why it's named that is because there's a mural on the wall of Cinderella. And in that room, there's also a full-length portrait of Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse, dressed as the King and Queen of Hearts.
Oh, wow.
In the Great Hall, there's a floating staircase in the centre of the room, but it doesn't have railings because fairy folk don't need railings. They balance themselves with their wings. And then in the fairy princess bedroom, the bed represents the bed that Sleeping Beauty slept in. And the bedspread is the gold spider web that covered her for 100 years as she waited for Prince Charming. And then the last one I'll mention is the Magic Garden, because the Magic Garden's so, so lovely. It's actually a really kind of personal element to the castle as well, from Colleen Moore's perspective, because the cradle in the rocking tree was made with jewellery from her grandmother, which she inherited when she was a child. And the Wizard of Oz is told on one of the garden walls, the story of the Wizard of Oz. And over the arched doorway, you can see Aladdin with a genie coming out of his lamp. And then there's a silver coach waiting to take Cinderella to the ball.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, it in itself is exquisite. As you say, it's one of those beautiful, beautiful things. But the story with this dollhouse is that it went on to do a lot of good. So when it was complete in 1935, Colleen organised a national tour of the castle to raise money for children's charities, because of the Great Depression, there had been a lot of financial hardship for a lot of people. So the tour was a huge success and raised a lot of money. And then in 1949, it came to the Museum of Science and Industry, where it is now on display. And actually, they also have a really cool film of it being put back together after a major conservation project. So you can literally see people rebuilding it bit by bit by bit. And it gives you a sense of the scale too, because it is big. And it gives you some really nice close-ups. And also, in the film, it says that some of the items were so small that masks had to be worn to stop people inhaling bits.
What?
I know.
Like, don't breathe. There's a bit of chair.
You've got to wear a mask to not breathe in any enchanted castle bits.
That is, I mean, that's a hazard I'm willing to work with.
Yeah.
I would take the risk of potentially enchanted objects going down my windpipe.
Yes. Well, anyway, so that is the story of Colleen Moore's fairy castle. So it's a beautiful thing in itself that came from someone's lifetime love, and it went on to raise some funds for a lot of people.
It's seriously beautiful. Yeah, I was not prepared for the levels of beauty.
Oh, it's amazing, the details that went into it. Can I just say as well, I know it will never be played with by children, but if I could have even a tiny bit of that as a dollhouse to play with when I was younger, I would play with it now.
Same.
I'm a grown woman. I'd play with it now. Honestly, it's so lovely. So, what did you find?
So, as we all know, I've had a time of it this week, trying to get myself together and actually come up with something to share. But actually, I am really pleased with this discovery. We are venturing to the collection at Hilltop in Cumbria.
Ooh!
Yeah, which some of you might recognise as the home of author and illustrator Beatrix Potter. Because if you go on a tour at Hilltop, you will see a dollhouse in the upstairs room. And if you are a Beatrix Potter connoisseur, you may remember that she wrote a story set in a dollhouse with two little mice as the main characters. So the story is about this beautiful dollhouse and two dolls live in it, Lucinda and Jane. And one day Lucinda and Jane leave. They go on a little walk in their perambulators for dolls. And in their absence, two mice called Hunka Munka and Tom Thumb enter the nursery. They see that there's a dollhouse. They break in, essentially. They get very, very mad that all of the food that they see is not actually edible. And then they just destroy the house, kind of in a hangry rave. In a hangry rage.
But also in a hangry rave.
In a hangry rave. And yeah, I mean, I think they're just so annoyed. They start stealing bits of furniture. So they steal a cot, they take it out of the house and through the mouse hole. Hunka Munga, who's the lady mouse, she rips up like a bolster or something. She takes the feather bed and they have a hard time squishing it back through their mouse hole, but they succeed. Pots and pans, all of that, they steal it all. They really do wreck the dollhouse. So that's the plot in a nutshell. And it ends in a humorous way because the owner of the dollhouse? I can't remember if it's the owner of the dollhouse, but the mice come back and there's been a policeman doll installed, keeping watch over the house. But the reason for all that. So where do dollhouses come into it? Other than being an amazing setting for a novel, Beatrix Potter got the inspiration for A Tale of Two Bad Mice from a dollhouse that her editor was building for his niece. She saw it under construction. And around the same time, in June 1903, she was staying with her cousin in Gloucestershire and they caught two mice in a trap in the kitchen. And Beatrix Potter kept them. She rescued them. And she decided to, I guess she just had this idea with the dollhouse happening and there being mice, she got this idea for a story. And the editor really liked the idea. He was very keen that she write it, so he got her a little glass-fronted mouse house cage thing to keep them in so she could observe them and draw them. And she became really, really fond of them. And these mice were called Hunka Munka and Tom Thumb.
Oh, of course they were.
Yeah, so the plot is based on these two real mice. And Hunka Munka in particular was Beatrix Potter's favourite. They played together all the time. Beatrix Potter said she had a very friendly disposition, so she seemed to have like tamed this mouse into doing her bidding and posing for all of these little drawings. And they had a great time together. The names, I should say, are from a play by Henry Fielding called Tom Thumb. So that was the inspiration. There's also like another really interesting angle on this story, which kind of brought it all together for me. This was a story that Beatrix Potter and her editor, Norman Warne, worked very closely together on. And they fell in love. Aww. They corresponded a lot about the plot. He would give her feedback. He arranged for tiny pieces of dollhouse furniture to be sent to her house so she could copy it. So things like the ham that you see in the book, the ham that's on the plate that the mice are trying to cut into, but they're really angry that they can't. That was from Hamleys, and Norman bought it and had it sent to Beatrix Potter so she could copy it. And if you look in the dollhouse at Hilltop, you will see these tiny pieces of specially bought furnishings and food that she copied from. So they spent a lot of time like writing to and fro as they were refining the idea for the story, and he had to send her photos of the dollhouse that he was making for his niece, because that became the doll's house of the story. Sadly, Beatrix Potter's parents were not approving of the marriage because they thought he was beneath her in station. She was living in London at this time, so she'd not yet come up to the Lake District and wasn't living at Hilltop. That happened in the years that followed, but her parents wanted to keep her at home where she could continue to help them with the house and kind of just be a glorified servant, I guess. Like, they just really weren't up for her having freedom. So she wasn't ever allowed to go and visit the dollhouse in person. There is suggestion online that she did see it with her own eyes while it was being constructed, but nothing beyond that. It was all done from photos. So yeah, that is kind of how that came to be. And in 1905, I think it was, Norman proposed to Beatrix Potter and she said yes. So it doesn't have a happy ending because he sadly died of some sort of leukemia, I think it was, before they could marry. And It was after that that Beatrix Potter bought Hilltop and came up to Cumbria. And the dollhouse that you see at Hilltop is not the dollhouse that the story was inspired by, even though I think in some places there is confusion about that. There are pieces in the dollhouse that you can see in illustrations that Beatrix did for Two Bad Mice, but the dollhouse itself is not the same dollhouse. That dollhouse that is currently at Hilltop was... she acquired it while she was living up in Cumbria. Years and years later, I think she was in her 70s by this point. She never actually owned one while she was writing the story. But that just came from a sale of a house in Hawkshead, and they were getting rid of all the contents, and it was believed to look kind of similar, so she ended up with it. But the real doll's house, the one that belonged to Norman's niece, no one knows what happened to it. It was potentially given to a children's hospital. That was at Beatrix's suggestion because there was kind of a scandal. Norman's brothers, who also worked for the family publishing editing company, one of them was arrested and was doing time for embezzling funds. So they offered Beatrix Potter the dollhouse at that point, and she turned it down because she didn't want her parents to kind of know about the scandal and keep it all under wraps and things like that. So she didn't take it, but she suggested that they give it to children's hospitals, and then there's no further information on where it ended up, but it's not the one at Hilltop.
Oh, I wonder if it was hard for her to turn it away. I wonder if she genuinely did just wish it to bring joy to children elsewhere, or if she might have wished to keep it.
I think if there wasn't the scandal around it, she probably would have.
Yeah. You got there in the end. You found a really good one.
I know. I just love the little mice.
Yeah.
It's now time for our item spotlight of the week. So Melissa, please do tell about the leech in the walking stick.
I shall tell you. So of course you are wondering, why on earth would you ever wish to include a leech within a walking stick? Why would you ever need that? So this is a 19th century wooden walking stick that would have belonged to a gentleman. We don't know who, but certainly to a gentleman, considering how it looks. It's quite fancy. And in it, it has a cavity inside its metal handle to hold a leech. Bleeding using leeches had long been accepted as a cure for medical issues, and one of the best ways to draw blood was, of course, to pop a leech on your bod and let it do its thing. So, did you know that a leech can drink up to 5 times its own weight in blood?
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that? Because I didn't, and when I read that, I felt a bit sick.
I'm feeling rather nauseous right now.
Yes, anyway. Let's carry on. So, this stick is in the Whipple Museum of the History of Science in Cambridge, and in its object catalogue description, it says, physicians would have transported their leeches in a pewter box with a perforated lid. Less common, but perhaps a more stylish form of transport, is the leech stick. Here, the leech would be housed in the top of an adapted walking stick. And it is very fancy, so it's a brass-shod wooden walking stick. The stick is varnished. The handle is decorated with a pattern of leaf and berry-bearing branches. And then the little leech compartment is described as a door with external hinge opens to reveal a leech cavity bounded by the cylindrical metal wall and hollow pommel of the handle and the unvarnished terminus of the wooden stick. Door also carries holder for needle, and the pommel of the handle bears a monogram.
Oh.
So, it seems to be implying that a gentleman, perhaps a doctor, a medical professional, would walk around with this stick and then, you know, should anyone need to be bled in an emergency, he could just be like, aha, pop my leech out, stick it on your leg, and we're good to go. That seems to be what is suggested. Now, I don't know if this is a serious thing or whether it was a joke contraption or like a, you know, a funny gentleman's ha-ha. Like, was it real? I couldn't find anything to say that these were actually used in seriousness. But then maybe this stick belonged to an eccentric gentleman who did like to be prepared with leeches at every opportunity and found it more convenient to stick them in a walking stick, rather than carry them in their pewter box. So, yeah. Or on the other hand, was it just something you'd, you know, pop out at a dinner party or something? I don't know. But what I do know is I was scrolling through Twitter looking for interesting objects, as I often do, and the Whipple Museum tweeted about it. It was a few days ago now that they did, but I saw it and I was like, that's a perfect item spotlight. So thank you, Whipple Museum, for sharing the leech walking stick on your Twitter account. And be sure, everyone, to go and check it out. That brings us to the end of this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening, and we really hope you enjoyed it. Next week, we are going to be talking about servants. So we thought we'd use that theme to try and dig out some really interesting objects and stories about servants through the ages. And I'm sure we will.
Life below stairs. Because servants, you know, servants have got all the goss. There's going to be some really interesting things unearthed there, I think. Some lesser known stories, hopefully. We'd also just like to say a massive thank you to anyone who has left our podcast a review on Apple Podcasts. I don't think you can do it on Spotify, but if you've reviewed our podcast, thank you so much. It really does help us climb those charts and gain some recognition, which is not all that easy to do as a smaller podcast. We really do appreciate all of your comments and all of your kind words. They really do make our week. Yeah, just thank you. Thank you so much.
I'm Melissa.
And I'm Poppy.
Thank you very much for listening.
And we'll see you next week.